To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA. Whether or not you fall into the decades begin with zeros camp, or the zero year is the last of the decade crowd, there's no denying the psychological impact of the odometer effect. 2010 feels like the start of something new.
The issues that we're concerned about as Latinos, they're really not relevant anymore. People are looking beyond that kind of civil rights kind of mentality. And that's going to be interesting because it's going to really be something to look at in terms of how our politics as Latinos is going to be defined, how we define ourselves as a community, as we become bigger stakeholders in this society.
Today on the program, prognostication. We've invited some smart friends to join us for the program to talk about what they're paying attention to as the year begins. Politics, technology, music, gadgets, and culture. Looking ahead on this edition of Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to talk about the news affecting the Latino community this week is Jacqueline Stevens. She's a professor in the Law and Society program at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a contributor to The Nation magazine. Welcome to Latino USA, Jackie.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you had a pretty extraordinary article in The Nation magazine this month titled America's Secret Ice Castles. We should just start out by reading the quote that you start your piece with. It comes from James Pendergraf, who at the time was the executive director of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement's Office of State and Local Coordination, a pretty official title, but he made this statement at a conference for police and sheriffs in 2008. And this is what he said. If you don't have enough evidence to charge someone criminally, but you think he's illegal, we can make him disappear. You have a government official basically saying we can make people disappear, and he's saying that on the record.
Right.
An American government official saying we can make people disappear. That's pretty extraordinary.
I agree. And actually, the person who first reported this is Sernada Reynolds of Amnesty International. And it resonated for her the way I think it's resonating for you, which is these kinds of statements are associated with, you know, like banana republics, with the governments that are not accountable to democratic processes. One of the things that is really great is that in this country, there is more accountability. And I was able to obtain a copy of this list. And in response to that, different activist groups have in the last couple of weeks been going to these places, confirming that they are unmarked, but doing something really great and engaging the agents who work there, and for the first time making the agents know that other people know they're there.
But it becomes kind of this weird, and your article is really extraordinary because it goes into a lot of depth here, but you get into this kind of strange place where you have armed immigration officials bringing undocumented or other people who may or may not have papers, right, or American citizens in handcuffs into kind of public buildings, but nobody knows that any of this is happening, right?
That's right.
And so they say that they're like sub-field offices. They're kind of hidden in plain sight.
That's exactly right. That's the best way to put it, is that they're hidden in plain sight. And I think that that's actually a deliberate strategy on the part of ICE. The government has not officially gone on record to say that they're putting these facilities in, you know, office parks and industrial areas and not marking them because they're afraid. But I think that that is one of the reasons that they're doing this. That's in contrast with law enforcement all over the country. Police stations don't hide from their neighbors.
So at what point does what the president believes in terms of so-called transparency actually trickle down to something like this?
As far as I can tell, I've been doing research on immigration law enforcement during the Bush administration and now under the Obama administration. There has not been a single change in the level of transparency surrounding ICE activities. And in fact, there hasn't even been a change in the personnel. The people who are doing public affairs for ICE now are the exact same individuals who are doing public affairs under the Bush administration. So I think that that is part of the problem, that there's very little direction through the Democratic administration over the control of information at ICE.
Ultimately, Jackie, what does it mean for all Americans, for anybody living in this country, that you have a system of immigration enforcement that is basically operating in the shadows, essentially, where you have a kind of secret detention centers with unidentified agents or plainclothes agents, and that all of this is kind of coexisting with us as we live our normal lives. What should it mean to all of
us? It's a provocation for vigilance. The information is hidden, but if people are diligent, it's accessible. And I think it's really, really important for people to pay attention to what's going on. ICE is doing its best to hide these activities. They drive in unmarked white vans. They often don't wear uniforms that identify who they are. They wear jackets that say police and not ICE. And they are housing people in these subfield offices, as well as in larger detention centers that are also unmarked. It's a cause of great concern, and I think it's great that people are starting to talk about this and pay attention to it.
Jacqueline Stevens, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you very much.
Jacqueline Stevens is a professor in the Law and Society program at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a contributor to The Nation magazine. She has a new book out as well, States Without Nations, Citizenship for Mortals, available from Columbia University Press. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Journalism is usually not in the business of foretelling the future. In fact, journalists only really feel comfortable when we have facts that we can report. Give us a date, a meeting time, the address of the garage where the meeting took place. Then we're happy. Give us a transcript of that meeting, and we're beside ourselves. So it's a little peculiar that we here at Latino USA are devoting today's program to prognostication. But we do this prognostication with this in mind. Trends start somewhere. What 3 years from now will seem like an obvious fact may be something that is right now in its infancy, early in January in the year 2010. So we've invited three smart friends of Latino USA to join me for this half hour to help us search for those incipient great ideas. We're not saying that everything we say today will come to pass, and we're not saying that any of this is certain. But what we are saying is, ask a few smart people what they're paying attention to, what they're watching, and you have a better than average chance of identifying something important just as it's beginning. So joining us today is Angelo Falcon. He's a political scientist and the president of the National Institute for Latino Policy. He joins us from New York. Welcome back to Latino USA, Angelo.
Nice to be here.
Shenny Jardin is co-editor of the very cool technoculture blog, boingboing.net. She joins us from Los Angeles. Hi, Shenny.
Hi, Maria. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Marcos Najera is an actor and the Latino Affairs reporter for public radio station KJZZ in Phoenix.
Maria, thanks for having me.
So I've got a short list here, which I'm, perfectly willing to launch into, things that I've been thinking about, from everything from like deep philosophical questions about American society to the latest, television show that my kids are making me watch. But I'd love to know what you guys are thinking about, what you guys are paying attention to. So Marcos Najera, you are, you've got this great life. On the one hand, you're a solid reporter and a journalist. On the other hand, you're a producer and an actor and in the theater. You're based in LA, but you kind of work a lot in the Southwest. What are you thinking about 2010? Let's start 2010 and, maybe the next decade too.
It's funny. What I'm really actually thinking about right now, Maria, is mental health. It's not the sexiest of topics or, the most jovial of topics, but that's what I'm thinking about right now. I'm thinking about how Latinos, we as a community and a group, we are treating our minds and how we're treating our bodies. And I'm worried, to be honest with you. The National Council of La Raza, a couple of years ago, they did a study on Latinos and mental health, and at the time, you know, I didn't realize that it affected me, but I remember it talking about how 1 in 10, I'm more like 1 in 11 Latinos who have mental health disorders actually contact a mental health specialist. And that didn't strike me until maybe the last 2 months when I started to realize that there's mood disorders that run in my family. And I started to kind of like look bigger and realize that mood disorders run throughout our community, and I don't know if we're talking about that. And so that's something that I'm really worried about, and I'm wondering if we're paying attention to the health of our minds. And, you know, I think there's depression that's happening in our community. There's substance abuse that's connected to mood disorders and mental health. Suicide rates are very high for our Latina girls, higher than other sets of young girls, and I worry about that.
You know what? That's so interesting, Marcos, because I would probably say those are the things that I'm thinking about too, and as well as kind of parenting and the next generation. But this issue of what's happening kind of with Latino youth, Latino mental health, I kind of talk about it, or I think about it in this, I've given it a name. I call it the U.S. Mambo, 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. So that on the one hand, it feels like you have this, you know, amazing possibility of advancement for the Latino community in general. And on the other hand, you have some really depressing statistics out there. And all of this is happening within the context of Latinos who live in the United States, whether or not they are here with or without papers. And I am so worried about the fact that, yeah, we just don't talk about it. And, you know, frankly, this Latino community, they're not going anywhere. So these issues of mental health, you know, depression, if we're seeing that in you know, teenagers who are, you know, I'm kind of depending on them being around when I need my my retirement funds and et cetera paid in. What's happening with this generation? So what do we need to do to talk about this stuff?
I think that we need to encourage, I like to say that transparency lessens anxiety. And so I think we need to encourage our young people to be brave enough to talk about their bodies, to talk about their minds, to talk about the fact if they're depressed, do you know? Because I don't think our parents talked about that. I don't think that we are really talking about that. It's nothing to be ashamed about. I mean, to have a strong mind is a good thing, you know, and to have a strong body is a good thing, too. So in the same way that I'm hoping that we can encourage them to be more honest about what they're feeling and thinking, I think that's a big step, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to kind of tie this in, Angelo, to the question of kind of political empowerment. Because on the one hand, it's as if, you know, you can have, again, this U.S. Mambo. You've got the Latino community who has kind of realized a real sense of political empowerment over the past, you know, with the election of Barack Obama, their participation rates, et cetera. And I always wonder about that kind of, you know, sense of esperanza coupled with this sense of, you know, there's a lot of sadness out there. There's a lot of depression out there, mostly because there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of immigration issues. But a lot of it has to do with the economy. So let's talk about the economy for a minute, Angelo. When you're looking at the economy, 2010, what pops out for you?
Well, first of all, I totally disagree with you about this mambo thing. I think it's more like a cha-cha-cha. That's the opinion of a lousy dancer. But anyway, I think you're right, though. I mean, we've always had to live through that. The idea that every time we make some sort of progress is something also that kind of pulls us back. And one of the things that's interesting is, as you mentioned, with Obama, with the Obama as the president, is this whole post, you know, racial idea, post-civil rights kind of society idea, where the issues, as Latinos are coming now of age, the issues that we're concerned about as Latinos, all of a sudden are basically being said that they're really not relevant anymore, that people are looking beyond that, you know, beyond this whole kind of civil rights kind of mentality. And that's going to be interesting because it's going to really be something to look at in terms of how our politics as Latinos is going to be defined, how we define ourselves as a community. And also it raises the fact that in many ways, you know, in our community, we've put a lot of our focus on elected officials as the people who are the leaders of many areas. And we need to diversify the kind of leadership that we have in our community, including making sure, you know, young people step up there. And also, I think what I'm going to see in the next, you're going to see all in the next 10 years, in an explosion in terms of the role of women in politics and in the, because it's already happening in the economy. Because I can't believe the kind of, you know, discrimination that occurs that creates a kind of inequality, not just in terms of race and ethnicity, which we deal with as Latinos, but in terms of gender equality. I mean, I look at the Congress, and I can't believe how few women in general are in the Congress. It's amazing. So I think we're going to see an explosion around the issue of gender equality and in ways that hopefully, you know, Latino community will participate and be a big player in that.
I think this might be an interesting place to bring in Shenny, which is, you know, when you think about what happened with those massive immigrant rights demonstrations that occurred in 2006, mm-hmm. and you think about the fact that the media and kind of, you know, texting and all of this whole way of communicating that's outside of the mainstream media, what do you see in terms of, you know, is that a way in, you know, on the one hand, we have Latinos who have pretty good numbers in terms of their buying of products, but not so great in terms of downloading information. There's kind of a gap there. So when you think of mm-hmm. Latinos and technology, Shenny, what do you see? Progress or stumbling blocks or something new that's going to kind of resolve this gap?
Mm-hmm. I think that just as you were talking about the Great American Mambo or Cha-Cha-Cha, I think that you could say that the same thing is true specifically within the field of technology. I mean, if you'd sort of dial back the clock to 2004, 2005, when blogs first started being something that was really exciting here in the U.S., there was so much hope that suddenly the Internet would mature into a medium that would provide a voice for Latino people in the United States that would be heard, a voice that couldn't be edited out of a television broadcast, a voice that couldn't be ignored because television or newspaper providers didn't think that there were enough people to pay for it. I don't think that potential has been realized. So just as we're talking about sort of the broader potential of rights and of fulfillment and of opportunity in the U.S. being realized, I don't think that the potential of the Internet as a democratizing medium has been realized for this population. But what I think about is, like, I think about the really small stories that I've witnessed personally in other countries. I spend a lot of time in Central America, and specifically in Guatemala. I volunteer with a small family nonprofit that does a lot of work in indigenous communities there. And just a few weeks ago, I remember sitting at the kitchen table, you know, next to a wood-fired stove, in a small Quiche village in the highlands in Guatemala. And the son of the family, who's now 15 years old, had just spent several hours coming home on the camioneta from a larger town, where he now interns with Telgua, with the largest telecom provider in Guatemala. And he pulled out these motherboards out of his backpack. This is the same backpack that he might be sent off to, you know, to get nishtamal ground at a diesel-powered mill down the street in their village. His backpack was filled with motherboards, and we talked about how he hopes to become an engineer at Telgua someday. And this is a village where they have to ration water, where once every 3 days they have water that's filled with pathogens. It's not safe to drink. Cholera is endemic. Where there isn't, you know, they don't have regular electricity. There are no landline phones. There are few flush toilets, and where everybody bathes in the tuch, the traditional sweat house. But young boys and girls, like this child that I was talking to, whether or not there's a program for them, whether or not there is a system in place to encourage that, they see the potential, and that is the dream. And that dream is fulfilling itself in ways that I wouldn't have imagined.
We're talking about trends to keep an eye on in the year and the decade ahead. Joining us on Latino USA this week is Angelo Falcon, Jenny Jardin, and Marcos Najera. We'll be back with more of the conversation in a minute. So, no se vayan. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. So let's talk about, I know, Marcos, that you recently were involved in a play that there were a lot of immigrant voices in this play, and there was a lot of code switching going on during the production of the play. In other words, suddenly the actors would be speaking in English, perfect English, and then they'd switch into Vietnamese, and then they'd come back and the other actors would switch into Spanish, and it was like completely natural, no big deal. I see this a lot. Well, it's happening more and more in kind of, primetime, major networks, just little tiny things of kind of bilingual moments. What do you see in terms of, on the one hand, that's really cool. On the other hand, for a lot of people, that is of great concern, right?
Oh, it's a huge concern. I think a lot of people are probably threatened about the idea of English and Spanish mixing, or any language other than English mixing together kind of out there in the mainstream airwaves and on our stages and on our websites, like what Shani produces. And I think that's really interesting. You know, one production I saw recently in Los Angeles was at the New Los Angeles Arts High School, and I found it so fascinating, Maria, because these young kids at the New Los Angeles Arts High School, they all come from the inner city of Los Angeles. They put on the production of La Llorona, but they mixed it with the Greek tragedy of Euripides, by Euripides' Medea. And they mixed it so naturally, it was like no big thing, you know. And so on stage, there was, you know, a Greek tragedy mixed with a Latino myth, and they mixed Nahuatl, and they mixed, you know, kind of like hip-hop dance mixed with Spanish flamenco, and it was no big thing. I mean, they just found a way just to let it live and breathe on stage, and for some reason, we can't really, it seems like we struggle with that out just on the mainstream airwaves. I'm not really sure why. I'm not sure why people are scared. What do you think?
I think that it's going to happen. It's already happening. I'm always fascinated by, wow, look at this younger generation. They just kind of flow with this stuff. Whereas for my generation, it was just a little bit more kind of self-conscious. It was a little bit more difficult. There were more problems around it. What do you see, Angelo, in terms of, you know, a Latino identity? Is there one really that we can talk about now when we're so mixed, we're so diverse, and so many of us have been here for so long? On the other hand, so many of us are really new to this country.
Well, you know, I think with the advent of, hip-hop, rap, and all that, and the way that kind of became mainstreamed, I think that major, major, I think, transition there in terms of American culture. And so, you know, I think as we look at the Latino experience, we started talking, one of the things that unifies any kind of Latino, you know, identity is the fact that still over 60% of the Latino population is Mexican-American. One of the things that's clear is that terms like Hispanic and Latino, these kinds of umbrella terms, are really American constructs. I mean, they're not something that we bring over from our countries of origin. And so a lot of that stuff is constant, contestation in terms of, you know, who's defining it and what way they're defining it. Like I said, you have all these market researchers, these companies that are trying to form, you know, their own version of Latino identity that is compatible with their ability to basically make a profit. You have companies like Univision, Telemundo that, you know, trying to create this kind of broad market that they can access, and they influence, you know, how we look at ourselves as Latinos. So there's a lot of competition in terms of who defines us, how we define ourselves. And I always bring back the story when I talk about this, about how people like Jesse Jackson and other black leaders took that transition from the term black to African American and did it in a very conscious way. I mean, they had a press conference and they announced, you know, we're going to be referring to ourselves as African Americans. They explain why. And we haven't seen a movement like that, I don't think, within the Latino community. I mean, we're still having major debates about Latino versus Hispanic, you know, and that's even complicated because, you know, you do look at surveys, and most surveys, most folks that are Mexican-American, Puerto Rican, et cetera, identify when they're asked to as Hispanic. But then, for example, when you look at surveys done on the web, people who are internet users, they prefer overwhelmingly to use the term Latino. So even along those lines, in terms of the general Latino population and those that, for example, participate within the internet, very big differences in terms of how they find themselves as a community.
So what about that, Shenny? On the one hand, that you can have, the kind of freedom that, let's say, you know, in your world of technology that, you know, there are no borders in technology. But on the other hand, it's like borders, razor walls, you know, walls, literal walls, or cyber walls are being thrown up all around us in so many different ways. What do you think about those two kind of divergent ideas?
I would say that technology doesn't make the world borderless, but it helps us cope with those borders. I think all of the TSA craziness at the very end of the year with the attempted airplane bombing and all of the nuttiness that's now happening with the security theater and airports, with the likelihood that racial and ethnic profiling will manifest in ways that we haven't seen just yet, those are all frightening, and those all reinforce elements of borders and division that I think many of us find as cause for concern. The internet and different forms of social networking technology, different forms of communication technology, even something like Skype, which I'm using right now to communicate with you all on this conversation. All of those things add up to ways that we cope with political division, with geographic division, with cultural division, but they don't erase the borders. I'd like to see that myth disappear in 2010.
That's fascinating, Shenny. How come you don't feel it erases borders?
The borders are still there. The discrimination is still there. The reality that when the reality of racism, the reality of social discrimination, and the reality of the wall between the U.S. and Mexico, literally in some places, that is real. Me getting on Facebook or you using hashtags on Twitter doesn't erase that, but these technologies allow us a way to cope with that, to cope with those borders, to cope with that reality, so that those limitations, those externally imposed limitations, don't cripple our communication. But the borders still do exist.
Shenny, great to have you on the show.
It's my pleasure.
Angelo, thanks for joining us.
Well, it was a pleasure. It was a very stimulating discussion.
And Marcos, good to have you back on.
Maria, thank you, and Happy New Year.
Jenny Jardin is co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Marcos Nájera is an actor and the Latino Affairs reporter for public radio station KJZZ in Phoenix. And Angelo Falcón is the president of the National Institute for Latino Policy in New York. And you can hear an extended version of our conversation online. Visit us at latinousa.org. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. Our listener comment line is 1-800-535-5533. And our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio, and the Marguerite Casey Foundation. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From NPR, it's Latino USA.
As long as girls and women are valued less, not schooled, subjected to violence in and outside their homes, the potential of the human family to create a peaceful, prosperous world will not be realized.
In 1995, then First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton spoke those words to a United Nations conference on women. But 15 years later, that dream is yet to be realized. On today's program, Human Rights and Women. In Honduras, an untold story of how political violence is now focusing on women.
The message that the police or security forces involved repeat, which is, this is what will happen to you if you come into the street. Most of the threats are sexual, you know, we'll destroy you if you come in the street.
And from Mexico, we look at the legacy of a champion for the rights of women. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. For the news affecting the Latino community this week, a focus on the economics of immigration. And I'm joined by Dr. Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles. Welcome back to the program, Raul.
Good to be here, Maria.
So just full disclosure, you are my brother and we have interviewed you because you are a top economist from UCLA and you've just released a report this month from the Center of American Progress looking at the economic benefits of comprehensive immigration reform. And at the center of this report is essentially what you are saying, that 1986 major immigration reform, and your report says that when they legalized all of these undocumented workers, it was a net gain for the American economy. And so basically you're saying that if undocumented workers now were all legalized, it would also be a net gain for the American economy. Tell us a little bit more about how you got to this point.
Well, what we saw is that from during the first 3 years of implementation, the wages of the undocumented rose close to 15 to 20%. This is after having been flat or declining for over 10 years. So what this told us is that legalization, what it would immediately do would be a shot in the arm in terms of the potential wages and, very importantly, also the productivity. Workers become much more productive once they get out of the shadows.
So the Immigration Reform and Control Act, or IRCA, is passed in 1986 and basically goes into effect 2 years later. And it's in 1988 when there's a recession in the United States. And your report is saying that even though there was a recession, if you legalized these millions of undocumented immigrants, it was good for the economy in the middle of a recession? That doesn't seem to make sense, though.
Except that's exactly what happened. What this shows us is that even in the condition of a recession, we have a huge pent-up economic potential in the fact that immigrants have been kept back in terms of their ability to have better productivity and command better wages for the services that they provide to the society. What we say is that in the next 10 years, if you look at where the economy is growing and the amount of immigration it's going to require, we would be in much better shape now, rebooting the economy, moving towards a legal system of immigration, whereby people would have higher wages now and into the future, the immigrants would come in with greater rights and be able to more effectively contribute to the economic growth of the country.
So you're basically, your report is predicting that were undocumented immigrants now to be legalized on a massive scale, it could be $1.5 trillion in growth for the GDP of this country. And and you also said that there would be wage increases for undocumented immigrants. But what about unskilled American labor? Don't they suffer because of all of this? Don't their wages go down?
The reality of it is that immigration is very complementary to virtually all the labor force of the United States. In other words, they bring in goods and services which make other people more productive in what it is that they do. What's important to understand here is that the United States is year after year actually producing less and less unskilled labor.
You actually study also a scenario where if there was massive deportation of undocumented immigrants in the United States, you actually have a prediction of what would happen to the American economy. And probably a lot of people think if you deported everybody, there'd be more jobs and the economy is going to going to grow if you deport? And actually, from your prediction, what happens with massive deportations?
That would reduce economic output in this country by $2.6 billion over the next 10 years. That would make the current recession mild, you know, by comparison in terms of what type of a hit we're talking about.
What about the possibility of immigration reform and if you will, it being whittled down so that there isn't that much of a real impact? Are you concerned about that and what the debate will look like in the halls of Congress?
Standpoint, immigration reform is going to be very difficult, obviously, because the conventional wisdom, number one, is that under conditions of unemployment, you can't do legalization. What we show here is that going towards a more maximal type of legalization now for everybody and legal framework for immigration into the future is absolutely the best from an economic point of view.
Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, thanks for joining us on Latino USA.
My pleasure, Maria.
Dr. Raul Hinojosa Ojeda is a professor at UCLA and the author of the report Raising the Floor for American Workers. It's available from the Center for American Progress and at our website at latinousa.org. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. More than a few stories from 2009 will be with us in the coming year. One of them is the coup in Honduras. Today we're joined by Lisa Veneklassen, who is monitoring the situation in Honduras through Just Associates, a global women's rights group. She says there's widespread abuse of activists, especially women, who opposed the coup that ousted President Manuel Zelaya last summer. Lisa Veneklassen, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You've been watching and monitoring the situation, but give us an overall of exactly what happened once Manuel Zelaya was ousted. What happened? What was the role that women started to play, and how did that happen?
On June 28th, when Manuel Zelaya was removed from the country, the women were preparing a meeting for a constituent assembly, a process to rewrite the Constitution. And within about 2 days, probably 40 women got together to start talking about what to do. And within 24 hours, there was a network of cell phoning, calling, organizing among women's organizations, calling their colleagues in the trade unions, calling their colleagues in radio, connecting across different civil society organizations. And a new umbrella organization was formed, which called itself Feminists in Resistance. The position was very clear of the feminists from the very beginning, which was to demand a reinstatement of constitutional order. And it was a very strategic decision not to be partisan and not to focus on bringing President Zelaya back, but rather the reinstatement of constitutional order.
And what was the response that they were met with?
Immediately, the police and security forces were mobilized to control the demonstrations in the streets, and it very quickly became violent. The women early on took on the brunt of some of the violence, and the violence took on very specific forms for women. There are 7 reported cases of gang rapes, and the statistics are hard to really verify because the institutions, the justice institutions and human rights institutions of government have been taken over by the de facto government.
So it's hard to basically get any numbers because you're not sure exactly who's giving you the numbers, is that it?
That's right. And so we were part of an international women's human rights delegation that went in August to document, and through that process we're able to document 243 cases of sexual and violent abuse directed at women in the context of the coup. And there's a very clear pattern because in the cases of gang rapes and in other reported violations, the message that the police or security forces involved repeat, which is you're a whore,
you know, we'll destroy you if you come in the street. And in several cases, the police used condoms, which gave the impression that this was an intimidation tactic that was premeditated.
So what would you like to see from the Obama administration, from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton? What would you like to see them do now? What would be the thing that they could say or do that might have an impact in terms of what's happening with women in Honduras?
I think it's really critical that the U.S. be more visible by clearly indicating the U.S. will not reinstate aid and will not reinstate diplomatic ties if human rights abuses are not addressed. And so the U.S. has called on the Honduran government to set up a truth commission. But the truth commission is really, if you look at the details, it's not about investigating women's human rights violations or human rights violations in the context of the coup. It's more about investigating the cause and the sort of circumstances of the coup. We really need to make human rights violations central. You know, women's rights activists and Honduran citizens who really have felt that they've been fighting the good fight of democracy continue to look to the U.S. to firmly stand by them. And that hasn't happened yet. And I think the minimum the U.S. can do is state unequivocally that it will not reinstate aid to Honduras or diplomatic ties without clear action by the Honduran government to address human rights abuses and women's rights violations in the context of the coup.
Thank you so much for your work, Lisa.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Lisa Venneklassen is the founder of Just Associates, a global women's rights group. From Honduras, we go now to Mexico. The country has paid a steep price in the war between the government and the drug cartels, a cost easily seen in the body count. The border city of Ciudad Juarez has perhaps paid the most, with more than 4,200 drug-related deaths just in the last 2 years. But before this latest wave of violence, Ciudad Juarez was racked by a series of murders targeting women. In the early 1990s, the bodies of murdered women began appearing in the deserts surrounding the city. Most were poor and worked in the maquilas. They were raped and beaten to death, their cases often ignored by authorities. But one woman stood up and demanded that more be done for these victims. Her name? Esther Chavez Cano. Chavez Cano was a source of hope and strength in Ciudad Juarez. She founded a rape crisis center and advocated for the human rights of women. But on Christmas Day 2009, she lost a long struggle with cancer. She was 76. Chavez Cano's death was a blow to the human rights movement in the city. But as Monica Ortiz Uribe reports, her legacy lives on in the lives she helped change.
Sure, there were somber faces and tears at a memorial service for Esther Chavez Cano. But the ceremony wasn't a mourning of her death. It was a celebration of her life. Instead of the traditional minute of silence, Chavez Cano received a minute of applause and mariachis. Chavez Cano is said to be the first person to seriously investigate and denounce the wave of women's murders in Juarez at a time when the police and elected officials tried to underplay and hide the crimes. Her work is recognized internationally, and she received honors in Spain, England, and the United States. Mexican President Felipe Calderón presented her with the 2008 National Human Rights Award. For many Juarenses, Chavez Cano was loved and venerated almost like a saint. She was a petite woman, standing no more than 5 feet tall. Her face was grandmotherly and inviting. Her speech was mostly soft and tender. Though gentle on the outside, from the inside, Chavez Cano was ferocious.
She had a very, very gentle voice, and it was also the voice of a lion.
Brian Barger was a close friend of Chavez Cano. They met in 1998 when he was a reporter for CNN covering the serial murders of women in Juarez. Their initial meeting turned out to be a groundbreaking moment. Barger noted that Chavez-Cano was doing a lot for the murder victims, but asked what was she doing for the women who still lived.
That's where the idea of Casa Amiga was born.
Barger quit his job at CNN, put his 20-year career as a journalist on hold, and stayed in Juarez for 3 years to help Chavez-Cano found Casa Amiga, the city's first rape crisis center.
I'd been parachuting into story after story and documenting the tragedies facing people in all sorts of different arenas, and always feeling like I wanted to do more than just help tell their story. This was an opportunity to roll up my sleeves and really try to make a difference in the lives of many women and children.
At Casa Amiga, the life mission of Chavez-Cano lives on. Here, women and children who are survivors of all kinds of violence, mainly domestic, receive psychological counseling, legal advice, and social services. The center has a large, open lobby with pastel-colored walls. Every day, some 20 to 40 people walk in the door looking for help. Each year, thousands of people are reached through the center's violence prevention programs in schools and workplaces.
Casa Amiga is an icon when it comes to working against violence.
Irma Casas Franco is the director of operations at Casa Amiga. She's an unassuming 32-year-old who now holds the leadership position that belonged to Chavez-Cano. Her eyes still express a sadness for the loss of her mentor.
Yo creo que Esther...
I think Esther always had it in her heart and in her mind to help others. She had that sensibility that many of us are missing. It's a sensibility which allows you to see the pain of others.
Often, Chavez-Cano inspired others to channel their pain into something positive. Arsène Van Nierop is the mother of Hester Van Nierop, a 27-year-old Dutch woman who was murdered in a Juarez hotel room while on her way to the United States. Moved by Chavez-Cano's activism, Arsène Van Nierop began her own foundation, which donates $24,000 a year to Casa Amiga.
It was my way to fight against the criminal people at the other side of the world. If I could make the women more powerful, they could fight themselves against this criminal situation.
Fellow activists described Chavez-Cano as a force of nature and a hero. She was an accountant who found her life's mission when she was in her late 50s. Her demand of justice for the women of Juarez reached a high point in 2004 when she protested at the head of an international march in Juarez alongside Sally Field, Jane Fonda, and Eve Ensler. Journalist Brian Barger says she leaves a great legacy.
You know, there are plazas and statues of Mexico's heroes dotting the city of Ciudad Juarez, and Esther is going to stand among them now. The city has decided to name a street after her, and I imagine that before it's all over, they'll even have a Plaza Esther Chavez-Cano. I would not be surprised. She certainly deserves it.
One friend recalled Chavez-Cano standing alone in front of the federal police building, a single gray-haired protester denouncing the detainment of a fellow activist. She held a poster that read, "To protest is a right. To repress is a crime." For Latino USA, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
In a minute, the tumbao of Latin jazz pianist Paquito Echavarria. That's coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
I'm gonna write. While there's no mistaking the cool jazz classics made famous by old Blue Eyes himself, Mr. Frank Sinatra, there's also no mistaking the tumbao of Cuban pianist and Latin jazz artist Francisco Paquito Echavarria. Born in Cárdenas, Cuba, Echavarria has been playing the piano for nearly six decades, beginning his career in the great Cuban bands like Conjunto Casino and Orquesta Riverside. And here in the United States, he's worked with artists like Frank Sinatra, Julio Iglesias, and Gloria Estefan. Paquito Echavarria has just released his first major studio debut, dedicated to Frank Sinatra. It's simply entitled, Frankly. Paquito Echavarria, welcome to Latino USA. It's good to have you.
Maria, me gusta ese nombre. I love that name.
I actually think I'm going to have to ask you if you wouldn't mind doing something for us in terms, Paquito, in terms of the tumbao.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just want everyone to know what a Cuban tumbao is. And actually, even the word important, because actually the word is actually tumbado, right?
Well, it's it is a slang word, but the thing is that tumbao is, if you are the piano player, you have to have the rhythm to do it too. You have to be a percussionist piano player.
Would you mind just doing that little combination in my ear?
Oh, come on,
did like,
man.
What, 12 seconds? Oh, please, in my ear.
Well, I would say, all right, I do it for you. Say the rhythm goes like, tukutun kun kun, tukutun kun kun, tukutun tun tun. So the piano goes. Wow, man. Oh,
see, now that's why we love. That's
what is the tumbao. That's the tumbao.
And that's why we love Cubans, because within 1 second, you already had a whole band, and it's just you.
Oh, come on, man. You're making me laugh.
Why, Paquito? Let me ask you, Paquito, why at this point in your career, you've kind of done everything, played with the greatest, most well-known musicians, you decide to put out a CD. Dedicated to the music of Frank Sinatra.
For me, it's one of the best experiences that I have in a record, in a session with guys that are unbelievable, like Phil Woods, Brian Lynch, the guys who are in percussion, Daphne Prieto, and the bass player Andy Gonzalez, and the conga player Pedro Martinez. It is unbelievable.
There were so many things about the CD, the music, that made me smile because, again, it was songs that I recognized. I couldn't name them. You know, you start out with the song Change Partners, which is a classic by Sinatra. And you kind of do a change partners things, because you start out kind of with bossa nova, but then you end up going into the tumbaos. So that was a proposito. That was completely on purpose, right?
You got a very good ear, because that's exactly what I did. The introduction I made in Chair Partner was different than what happened later. And then I go into tumbao and blah, 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 you know. You got a very good sense of it. Are you a musician?
No, but I've always been surrounded by music. And okay. There's something about Cuban music, of course, that is really special, and you bring it again to something that is so unexpected. One of the songs, which was originally written by Cole Porter, I Love Paris, was one of the songs that you actually did, that Sinatra did with a big band with horns and violins, but you made it very Afro-Cuban.
Yes.
Talk to me about your decisions for the song I Love Paris.
Well, the musicians sitting in that studio got the same vibe to put it into that Afro thing, you know. That was a mystery. Sometimes there are things that you cannot explain why it happened, but it did happen.
So you really hadn't kind of planned it, because it does sound like, you know, you end up doing what is done in a bembe, which is a repeated chorus, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody is kind of singing the same thing and chanting. But instead of chanting I Love Paris, you start singing Como Se Goza en La Habana.
Como se goza en La Habana.
How sweet is
Como se goza en La Habana. Como se goza en París. Believe me, that was not prepared. That happens there because the spirits were helping us, I swear to God.
Paquito, I just want to say it's been an honor to have you on our show. Thank you for
taking
us into your musical journey. Paquito Chavarrias, thank you so much.
Thank you to you, my dear. You got a beautiful voice. Hey, go to New York, let me know where you are, all right?
De seguro.
Qué linda.
Paquito Chavarria's new CD is entitled Frankly. It's available from Sony. And for this week, this has been NPR's Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Latino USA is produced by Walter Morgan, Mincho Jacob, Angela Maldonado, Alex Avila, and Katie Davis. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. Visit us online anytime at latinousa.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.
From NPR, it's Latino USA, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. We all know those seven words used so often to describe Haiti, but the story of Haiti is much, much richer. Today, we'll explore the history behind the headlines.
I want people to know that it is the first black republic, and it's the first place in the world in modern history where slaves reclaim their liberty from their masters and created a nation.
On today's program, a conversation with Haitian-American writer Edwige Danticat on the spirit of the Haitian people. Also, a conversation about the other side of the island, the Dominican Republic, and the moving music of Haitian-American violinist Daniel Bernard Romain, DBR. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Joining us to discuss the news affecting the Latino community is Patricia Guadalupe, Washington, D.C. correspondent for Latino USA and a reporter with WTOP Radio in Washington. Welcome back to the show, Patricia.
Hey, Maria.
To start off with, Patricia, give us a sense of what's happening in Washington at the Capitol in terms of relief efforts for Haiti and for Haitian Americans in the United States.
Well, this is a pretty big mobilization. I mean, President Obama almost immediately after the earthquake announced $100 million in USA to Haiti, with more money coming. There's quite a mobilization here, which is pretty impressive, and it's been very, very fast. And the White House promises more money, and Congress is saying that absolutely they're going to help. I mean, this is one of the few times that Congress is right ahead backing the White House on this issue.
That's a lot of talk about what's happening for relief in Haiti. What about for Haitian immigrants in the United States, whether they're in the process of being legalized or they're here undocumented? What happens with their status?
Well, the White House, again, almost immediately granted them the temporary protective status, which basically stops all deportations. That affects about 30,000 Haitians who are here illegally, who were basically on their way to being deported. Those deportations are stopped, and TPS also means that about 200,000 Haitians in the United States that are here illegally are going to be able to stay here legally for up to 18 months, maybe longer, depending on whether they decide to renew it or not. And they can stay here legally, work here legally, because the TPS program basically says, you know, we really can't deport somebody out to another country that is in such dire need and such a devastated state.
So while President Obama is kind of unifying around the issue of Haiti and Haitians, he and the Democratic Party received quite a blow this week, specifically with the Massachusetts elections to fill the seat of Senator Ted Kennedy. The Democrats were stunned when Scott Brown defeated Democrat Attorney General Martha Coakley. The ripples of this election are going to be so many, health care being one of them. So tell us a little bit about this election and what do you think it means for Latinos in the future?
Well, the big problem with the Democratic candidate was that there was she was so far ahead in the beginning that they basically sat down on the job and really didn't do a lot of campaigning until it was too late. The Democrats don't lose their majority in the Senate, but they lose the 60 votes guaranteed that the minority party is not going to be able to block any kind of legislation. So with the Republican in there, they lose one of the most important seats in the Senate, replacing the so-called liberal lion. People are stunned. They just cannot believe that this has happened. And for Latinos, it means that some of the legislation that is going to be benefiting the community is either going to be much, much harder to go through or not even go through at all.
So do you think that health care will pass, and do you think that immigration is basically off the table with the election of Scott Brown from Massachusetts?
So a lot of people are very concerned about what that legislation is going to look like, because without a public option, without the federal government helping them pay for this, then the Latinos are going to be basically paying through the nose for health care that they may not want. Because remember, the legislation already says that legal immigrants have to wait 5 years in order to receive benefits, and undocumented immigrants are out completely. And that legislation wasn't in there in the beginning, but conservative Republicans stuck it in there. So with less Democrats in the Senate and more of a vocal conservative minority within the Republican Party. It looks really, really difficult for that. And for immigration reform, a lot of the groups, a lot of the advocates for immigration reform say, well, the Scott Brown win doesn't necessarily mean that immigration reform is going to be derailed. But for something to be derailed, it has to be on the rails to begin with. And there is no legislation at all, so there's no movement anywhere. So for them to say it has no impact is very naive.
Patricia, thanks so much for the update.
Thank you, Maria. Good talking to you.
Patricia Guadalupe is Washington, D.C. correspondent for Latino USA and a reporter for WTOP Radio. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The images continue, hour after hour. Rocks piled upon rocks, bodies piled upon bodies. So many lives lost, so few saved. People waiting, searching, bracing themselves as more aftershocks come. All the while in the news, a soundtrack with an often repeated refrain.
Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, a place where infrastructure is incredibly weak.
Considered the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, is said to be suffering a catastrophe of...
9 million people live below the poverty line.
Maybe we need this shorthand to make sense of what's happening in Haiti. Maybe we need it to keep a certain distance from it. We wanted to come closer to the story and history of Haiti, so we called our friend Edwige Danticat, the author of so many books on her native country, including Brother, I'm Dying. She's a recent recipient of the Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. Edwige lives in Miami, and like all Haitians who are out of their country, she's tracking her family back home. Welcome back to the program, Edwige Danticat, and we want to let you know that we send our condolences to you. We just heard that your cousin Maxo passed away in the earthquake.
Oh, thank you. Like many Haitian families right now, we love my cousin Maxo, who I wrote about in Brother, I'm Dying. But even in his death, you know, there's this miracle of cooperation, because we had believed that he had died with his entire family, including his wife and four other children. But the neighborhood people, people with no means, no international help, had gone there with their bare hands and dug out his wife. There's great sadness, but also hope in the fact that he was so helped by all these people around him.
Edwige, as you hear and see, we are bombarded by these very disturbing images. What's kind of going on for you as you're thinking there's a context here that people don't know, don't understand, and that you desperately want Americans to understand about Haiti beyond the fact that it is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere?
Well, I want people to know that it is the first place in the world in modern history where slaves reclaim their liberty from their masters and created a nation. And it's a beautiful place. It's a place with an extraordinary culture, with great literature, with wonderful art and extraordinary music. And maybe they won't see this as the news, you know, starts to emphasize, you know, these more sensationalist thing, that this more desperation. But there's also a great deal of cooperation and people helping each other. Right now on the ground in Haiti, for the most part, from what people are telling me, it's mostly Haitians who are helping one another. They're just people sharing what little they have. And that sense of family, that sense of cooperation, I'm afraid, you know, will not be necessarily highlighted by the news coverage. But that is the soul of Haiti.
So when you hear that because the people of Haiti stood up and said, we will never succumb to slavery and we will form our own republic and we will stand against you, Napoleon Bonaparte, and somehow that this was their axe to bear. What goes on for you when you hear that?
Well, it's true in the sense that Haiti had done at that time something that was so defiant. We were in a slave-owning world at the time that Haiti declared its independence, and it was considered a bad example, and Haiti was isolated. The country was made to pay a debt for its independence to France. This tragedy, unfortunately, also has brought out all these people with their, you know, treasured stereotypes. You see a lot of the same tendencies that you saw in Katrina. And this also gives, unfortunately, a lot of people an opportunity to ignore this history, which is complicated, which is great, which is also tragic, but also turn it into this sort of whipping stick for a suffering population. Sometimes any kind of image of sort of a massive amount of black people brings out the worst in these commentators, so that when you're watching the news, sometimes they're saying the potential for violence. Even before there was one single image, they were just sort of like beating the drum towards it, like the potential for violence is great. But, I mean, the good news is that for people who know, and from everything that I've been hearing, is people who are just helping each other and doing just the best they can under very hard circumstances. And that's not the sexy news, you know, but in a lot of cases is what is happening.
There's an image that was pretty extraordinary. I saw many women wearing white, raising their hands and singing. There was another one, a story about a crowd of people camping on a soccer field, and then they started chanting, "Thank God that the earth shook and gave us a chance to begin again." This is pretty extraordinary, and you talk about this at the core of the Haitian people. What should we see beyond those images, Edwige? What do you want us to be hearing in our heads?
I think we can learn a lot about resilience, a lot about gratitude, but we don't need for people to suffer for those things. You know, there's a woman who was rescued today. I think she's one of the most recent, and she came out singing. And one of the reporters said to her, "Did you think you were going to live?" And she said, "Why not?" You know? And I thought that was extraordinary. And I thought these people are amazing because they're also countering the narrative that this reporter wanted, this woman, you know. Her sense of survival just counters this narrative. And I think that's what we can learn from these people, the ability to bear suffering that they shouldn't have to, but with such pride and with such extraordinary grace. And it's important for me to say that because it's the opposite of what people will be seeing as the situation gets in more and more desperate. But it's very important for us to remember when we're looking at these few people who are doing bad things, that we should also remember that there are these other people who are waiting, who are singing and strong, even in their worst hour of suffering.
Edwige Danticat, thank you so much for sharing some time with us in a very busy, hectic, and sad time in your own life. We really do appreciate your time, Edwige.
Thank you for having me.
Edwige Danticat is a Haitian-American author living in Miami. Her most recent book is Brother, I'm Dying. And to hear an extended conversation between myself and Edwige, go to our website at latinousa.org. We've been talking about Haiti, and now we want to put that nation into context, because it shares the island of Hispaniola with the Dominican Republic on the other side. So we wanted to understand a little bit more about the relationship between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. We're joined now by Michelle Wooker of the World Policy Institute. She's the author of a book, Why the Cox Fight, Dominicans, Haitians, and the Struggle for Hispaniola. Welcome to the program, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Wish we could be talking about this fascinating issue between the Dominican Republic and Haiti under better circumstances, but you have spent many, many years in your career understanding the relationship between the Dominican Republic and Haiti. It's a complicated one, but for our audience that might be new to some of this, what do you say about the relationship of Haiti to the Dominican Republic?
Complicated is a very, very good word. There are some big historical moments that stand out in the relationship between the two of them. Most prominently, in 1844, the Dominican Republic got its independence from Haiti. And the Haitian occupation in the mid-19th century was brutal, it was corrupt, it was part of a plan to use the Dominican farmlands to help to raise some of the money that Haiti was supposed to pay as part of a reparation to France for having won the revolution against France. The other pivotal moment was the fall of 1937, when the Dominican dictator, General Rafael Trujillo, ordered the murder of Haitians living along the border. They massacred, the best guess is probably between 25,000 and 30,000 Haitians.
You have the Haitian presence in the Dominican Republic still, in the sense that many see them as cheap, undocumented immigrant labor. In the Dominican Republic, Haitians are taking the poorest paid jobs, working the longest hours, have no protection. So give us kind of an up-to-date sense of the relationship prior to the earthquake.
We'd seen a real sea change since the mid-1990s in the relationship between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, because the governments of both countries, for the first time in a very, very long time, were not at odds with each other. You'd seen a lot of trade increasing between the two countries. You'd seen the number of Dominicans living in Haiti increasing. But then there were some very, very violent, terrible, terrible movements. Over the past few years, we've seen several cases of lynchings of Haitians in the Dominican Republic. And there are a lot of explanations for this. One is that over the past few years, Haiti has suffered a number of storms that have devastated the country. So there's been a perception that there's been an increase in the number of Haitians going to the Dominican Republic. And I think the other part of it is that when you have improvements, when you have people starting to get closer to each other, you're always going to have some setbacks at the same time.
So do you think that this could be a seminal moment that changes the relationship between the Dominican Republic and Haiti forever?
People who are trying to find some hope in the situation right now say, hey, maybe we can do some things right in Haiti this time. And I think that the future of the relationship between the two countries depends in no small part on just how well the rest of the world can do right by Haiti. It's not a coincidence that as Haiti has seemed to stabilize in many ways over the past couple of years, you've also seen improvements in attitudes towards each other. And those changes in attitudes, I think, have enabled what we've seen over the last week in rapprochement between the two countries.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Michelle Wooker is the executive director of the World Policy Institute and the author of Why the Cocks Fight, Dominicans, Haitians, and the Struggle for Hispaniola. And in a minute, a conversation about music, culture, and hope for Haiti with violinist DBR, Daniel Bernard Rumain. That's coming up on Latino USA. Quédense con nosotros. Hi, it's me again. This podcast of Latino USA is made possible by contributors to public radio stations. They help pay the freight and cover the costs of making the program available to you to hear when it's convenient. If you're already a member of your public radio station, thanks. If you're not, I hope you'll rethink that decision and make a contribution to support this program and others like it. Visit us at latinousa.org to find a public radio station near you and join the ranks of El Pueblo que Escucha Latino USA. Also, great opportunities exist for companies and organizations to reach the Latino USA audience online, on air, and through these weekly podcasts. If you're interested in having a tremendous impact on the production of this program, consider underwriting Latino USA. For more information, visit us at latinousa.org/support. And thanks for listening. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. You probably didn't know this,
But the American experience has been greatly affected by Haitians, ranging from politics to the arts. In fact, the city where I grew up, Chicago, was founded by a Haitian American. In literature, there are authors like Edwige Danticat, and in music, you have innovators like Daniel Bernard Rumain. Daniel Bernard Rumain, also known as DBR, is a violinist, composer, and bandleader. DBR was classically trained, but when he picks up the violin, you can immediately hear the fusion of cultures that he grew up in: hip-hop, jazz, rock, and of course, his Haitian-American roots. DBR's most recent album is Etude for Violin and Electronics, and he joins me now on Latino USA. Welcome to the program, Daniel.
Oh, thank you so much, and it's a real pleasure and honor to be here with you.
Well, it's an honor to have you with us. I have to tell you, Daniel, that when I started listening to your music, you know, given the fact that we are all just so much in the mind of what's happening in Haiti and Haiti as a country and what we're learning from Haiti, and then I hear your music and there's this kind of profound, oh my God, there's melancholy, there's movement, there's desire, there's hope. You are a Haitian immigrant. You grew up in Miami. Tell me a little bit about your background and how you see your expression in music.
Well, I'm the son of Haitian immigrants, yes. Both my parents were born in Haiti, my father in Port-au-Prince. I was actually born in Chicago. My sisters and I moved to South Florida, not far from Little Haiti. My mother ran what would be called a Haitian household. And she spoke Creole and French and Spanish. And my father had a very eclectic record collection, everything from Al Stewart to ABBA to Jackson 5 to Beethoven and Herbert von Karajan to Tito Puente and Celia Cruz and Thelonious Monk and Joan Armatrading.
Oh, wow.
Joan
sounds
Armatrading.
Like a really, yeah. And you were in Miami and you're growing up hearing all this stuff. It sounds great.
Well, that was in our home, and yes, we were surrounded by people who had similar homes, just as diverse, in some cases even more diverse, and it was a wonderful mix of people and music and message and meaning. I think that diversity continues to carry me, and it's in many ways reflected in Haitian culture. I mean, Haitian culture is a Creole, a patois, a rich blending and mixing of European and African cultures, and of course Caribbean cultures, and I think the music and the people embody a very complex history and mythology that is unfolding now in many real and unfortunate ways.
So when you sit these days with your violin, and I'm asking if you would do this for us, can you just take us to where you might be when it's just you and your violin and your working out the emotions of these past several days?
You know, I was in New York, in Harlem, when the 9/11 happened, and I remember playing my violin. And you're right about that. I mean, for me, I don't really cry a lot, you know. I express myself best to simply play. So let me play for you what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking, my musical response to the images that I'm sharing with you that are on our television sets and our laptops every day. This is what it sounds like to me.
Thank you.
It sounds that was really beautiful, and actually I was just making sure I wasn't going to start bursting into tears, because it felt like at the end, Daniel, that you were almost with your violin asking why.
Oh, that's it's okay to cry. And I don't know. There's, to me, tears suggest questions. They suggest something that's unresolved, you know? So two notes. I think you're right. Is it a question, you know? And why? Yeah. And it's funny because unless you had said that, I would never have thought that. So I appreciate that. And, well, why? That is the question, isn't it? I'm sure it's the question that every Haitian in Haiti is asking right now. Why?
Daniel, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your music with all of us. We so appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Daniel Bernard Roumain is a musician. His latest album is Etude for Violin and Electronics, available from Thirsty Ear Recordings. His website is on our website at latinousa.org. And for this week, this has been Latino USA. Thanks for listening. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. To find out how you can reach Latino USA's listeners, visit us online at latinousa.org/support.